Stanley Turrentine and his famous tune, River's Invitation. It is one of my all-time favorites and by one of my all-time favorite musicians. It's from his 1965 album, Joyride. I always remember that I lent this album to a friend of mine way back in my college days, and never got it back. And I seethe every with rage every time I remember that. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. A couple of things. I'm apprising you, if you hadn't been told before, or we didn't have a chance to connect with you, our system is being repaired, and that means we do not have the facility of a very important part of that system as it relates to me and to everybody else broadcasting, and that is that the phone system is being repaired. So it's a pretty intricate job, and it will take some time. The forecast is hopefully by Friday we should be back in full steam, and certainly if not by Monday of next week. But let's keep our fingers crossed about that. Secondly, I just want to let you know what we're going to be talking about today. The election in Alabama will be on us in our second part of our program. And it's because while people are very excited, they're not excited about the discussion that we ought to be having. So I take it in stride. I'm not going to, be out there eager to tell you something. What I'm eager to tell you about, practically nobody is eager to tell you about. So we'll take some time telling you about these things and discussing these things among ourselves, because this is a very significant election in one way, and in another, not at all different from life in the apartheid United States. But first, let's go to my colleague here at PRN, and even before, Paul DiRienzo, who is joining us now. We'll be talking about matters nuclear. So let's get to that. Investigative reporter, author, educator, and activist Paul DiRienzo has been reporting on Lead Stories, as you know, about the scary state of nuclear programs and facilities in the United States. And now he turns his attention toward Europe's missteps and mishaps with malfunctioning nuclear systems and the devastating challenges and consequences they're having way beyond their borders. Paul, I am so delighted to have you with us today.
Hi.
Okay. Am I sounding okay to you?
Yeah, I think I have an
Okay.
echo though of my voice.
But either way, we'll just muddle through.
Okay.
Where are you taking us today?
I'm taking you to the Southern Ural Mountains, near the city of Yekaterinburg, formerly known as Sverdlovsk, to a top secret city called Site 40 for many, many years, only recently given a real name, Oziorsk, in the Chelyabinsk region of Russia. And the reason I'm going to bring you there is because that's the location of the operating Russian plant called Mayak, where it still operates to this day. Actually, it's their Hanford, their place for making Russia's place, and before that, the Soviet Union's place for making plutonium fuel for their nuclear weapons program. And the site of the worst nuclear disaster in history, up to Chernobyl, and in some ways worse than Chernobyl. And it really gives you some ideas of what could happen in this country.
Okay.
And also that it's still happening right now. That plant is still operating. And in fact, just in the last few weeks, there have been very disturbing events that have happened in that region or traced to that region because of all the secrecy. We never can be 100% sure.
Well, in November, as you write in your last report, a cloud of radioactive material said to be from the element ruthenium appeared over Europe.
Interestingly enough, the ruthenium was discovered 100 years ago by scientists in Russia, and ruthenium is by coincidence happens to be the word for Russia before Russia was used.
In a very symbolic way, this begins the trek toward what is really happening with nuclear power plants and nuclear facilities in and around Europe. But you have been on this for a while, and you have uncovered a long list of mishaps that either were not reported, have not been reported, they have nonetheless had very damaging effects. And now, with these this contaminated material being just spewed into the air, we don't know
Right.
where it's
It's
come
less
from.
the ruthenium 106 is it was released in very, very low concentrations. In and of itself, it's not directly dangerous, but it does. Scientists and the public always looks to these releases because the only way we can have any idea of what's going on that might have caused the release is to try and draw that information out of what elements are found. For example, in 1949, I believe it was, maybe a little earlier, they had something out in Hanford called the Green Run. And they were so afraid, the Soviet Union had yet to explode its first atom bomb, and the United States was deathly afraid that the Russians were working on a bomb, which they were. And so, in order to detect the weapon in those days, they had very large, like refrigerator and larger size devices they needed. Today it's much easier. And they would load them onto airplanes and fly them up to the Russian border and try and scoop in the releases of nuclear radiation and try and tease out from the different radionuclides they found exactly what was going on in Russia. And so, which is a difficult thing to do then, difficult now, even more difficult in those days. So, in order to test their equipment to see if their equipment could, in fact, do that, they purposely released a humongous amount of radiation over the United States in order to test their equipment. It was called the Green Run because green fuel is usually what they do to make plutonium is they take uranium, regular uranium, and they put it in the middle of a nuclear reactor for a period of weeks and months. And then they pop it out the back into a pool of water, and it's glowing blue. It's incredibly radioactive and hot. And then they wait sometimes months to allow the initial extreme radiation to die down, so it's close, so they could actually get even there, close enough to pick it up with remote machines. And then they would move it to a plant and boil it down using nitric acid. And so basically, 2 tons of uranium would be boiled down in this huge building called the Queen Mary of the Desert. I've been in it. I've toured it at Hanford, both locations. One of the initial B reactor was made, the first operating reactor in the United States and the world. And then to the where they would take it by lead-lined train cars to the T plant, it was called. There were several different ones where they would, which was as big as the Queen Mary, and you could see it across for miles across the desert. It was so huge. And then they would put it in bath after bath of nitric acid, and 2 tons of incredibly radioactive radiated uranium would, in the end, produce 9 gallons of plutonium. So a little tiny bucket. So all the rest of that material was waste. In the early days of the bomb, they just dumped the waste into the Columbia River. And it washed up for hundreds of miles up and down the Oregon coast for years. Or they injected it into wells into the ground, or they just released it into the air. Or sometimes they just dumped it. Sometimes they had a pipe that just went out of the back of the reactor, and it just went out onto the dirt in the back of the reactor. Millions of gallons of this stuff, millions and millions, billions of gallons of it for years. And finally, Groves, who is the general who was in charge of the program, he was from that region. He was born and raised in that region. And he could, you know, he was a war man who didn't give a damn about anything. I talked to these 95-year-old guys who were there and did it. And they said, it's wartime. We were going to defeat the Japs and, you know, nothing was going to stop us. And that's the way it goes in wartime. So, and I don't think that's even changed to this day. And nothing, they didn't care about anything to do with the waste. They just dumped it anywhere they could. And then Groves, who was from the area, realized that one day the people of his community might hold him up to great approbation, sort of like Roy Moore, let's say. and he would be looked upon as a person who poisoned his own people. Facing that reality, I don't know why it took him like a few years for that to sink into his head. And one day he woke up in a cold sweat, I'm sure, and said, oh, my God, they're going to blame me for this. You know, today you can see streets named after him in Hanford, in Richland, which is a city near Hanford. You can see statues of him. He's like almost like a hero of American history and American military derring do. Could you imagine, you know, what they would have thought of him if he had kept doing that? So they decided they had to do something with this waste. So they decided to put it in gigantic tanks. Cast iron tanks, which were like designed to hold it for like a few years, wound up holding it to this day, you know, almost 100 years. And they're leaking like crazy. And there's 177 of them, and there's millions of gallons of unbelievably high radioactive waste. And some of these tanks hold as much as 1 million gallons. All right. So that's the situation today. It's the most polluted place, Hanford, Washington, near Richland, and Western Washington State is one of the most polluted places in the world, the most polluted place in the Western Hemisphere, and it's in the middle of a multi-$100 billion, hundreds of billions of dollars, hundreds of years program of cleanup that will never really be done, and is also sort of a big money, corrupt money sucker that according to many, many top people who worked on the project themselves, who whistleblew it, is being done in a Bozo the Clown manner and could lead to a great disaster happening. Now, you would say, Paul, how can you say that? Well, let's fly over to the town I introduced you to earlier, Ozersk in Chelyabinsk, Russia. There, they had the exact same thing. Right? And they had the same problem. They dumped their stuff into a place called the Techa River. And because of extreme secrecy, it was hidden for 40 years. In 1949 to 52, they just dumped it by the billions of gallons into this river, which is not even a fast-flowing ocean river like the Columbia River, but a large, slow-moving, windy little forest river in the Ural Mountains. It affected hundreds of villages until thousands of people died. Thousands of people, right? On September 29, 1957, pretty much 60 years, we're looking at the 60th anniversary, and it kept secret for 32 years, one of the tanks exploded, and it had 20,000 gallons of this super high waste in it. The tank exploded, and it totally devastated and polluted and killed everything in a 20,000 square kilometer area. And the United States has problems with leaks. We haven't had too many big explosions except the ones we wanted to have happen because our technology is quite good compared to the Russians. The Russians are doing it in a much more abbreviated form of technology, and they have big problems of things exploding on them all throughout their history. They're always trying to play catch up, right? And they're very good at it. I don't deny them the slightest, but they tend to even be worse on the safety part, and their disasters tend to be even more, as we saw from Chernobyl, ridiculously devastating than ours. Ours are more like these leaks, like these constant leaks and leaks and leaks, drip, drip, drip of disaster. There they have big explosions of disaster. And so thousands of people were killed. It was kept totally a secret, and the CIA knew about it. And the CIA kept it a secret from the American people because they didn't want to turn people against nuclear power in the 1950s because they had what they called Atoms for Peace, and they were busily, the U.S. is busily, they had just executed the Rosenbergs for giving so-called nuclear information to the Russians, and the U.S., within a few years after that horrendous crime against these people, this murderous injustice that was done against the Rosenbergs, the U.S. government was giving away nuclear secrets to all takers, including the government of Israel. And they didn't want anybody or anything to gum up the works of literally helping nuclear, you know, they gave it to Iran in the first place. They gave it to Iraq in the first place. Yeah. They gave it to so many countries. There were American engineers in the 1950s and 1960s in Iraq, helping Iraq build their nuclear plants, which every nuclear plant is a potential for making a fuel for a nuclear bomb. And so the U.S. was busily spreading it all over the world, even after they hypocritically had executed the Rosenbergs for allegedly doing the same thing, right? So years before, the Russians, who the U.S. wanted to attack, and the communists and socialists of the time, who liked Russia, were insanely trying to help Russia develop their own weapon for, believe me, for self-defense against the United States. And there's plenty of documents have come out that Russia had a lot to fear if the U.S. had gotten the bomb and held it for any length of time without the Russians' ability to stand up to the U.S. So that motivated people, a lot of people who had come to become communists or socialists in the 1930s to help the Soviet Union, absolutely. And the people who were in the bomb project were exactly the type of left-wing intellectuals, physicists, and scientists and people who came from that. One scientist from the Manhattan Project I saw in an interview, it was funny, he said, my entire time working there, I barely understood a word any of my colleagues said because their Russian and Hungarian and Polish accents are so thick. Not one of them spoke English without an accent. So, you know, these are the kind of people who were helping us. And so we started giving out all this information to everybody. So it was called Atoms for Peace. So the last thing the United States wanted to do was scare people by telling them that accidents such as this had happened. So they kept it a secret, and it didn't come out for many, 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 many years later. And there were since then many. In 2005, 60,000 gallons of nuclear waste was also spilled into the Techa River. In 2007, there was an accident in a reprocessing plant of nuclear waste because the Mayak plant, after the Soviet Union collapsed and became Russia, the United States and Russia became friends, believe it or not. Close friends. I guess we're close friends now, right, with the present president. And they began to, the U.S. and Russia made a deal where Russian scientists come into all our nuclear plants and our scientists go into all their nuclear plants. We see everything. They see everything, or what we say is everything. And we sent all our plutonium. We took apart thousands of bombs. We reduced the number of bombs the U.S. had and Russia had from like 30,000 to 5,000 or so each, which is, you know, from now, from being able to blow up the world thousands of times, we can blow up the world a couple of thousand times. So, and they had all this plutonium from these bombs and enriched uranium, and they didn't know what to do with it. So they basically made a deal and they sent it to Russia. And, you know, I tell people who were involved in the Cold War and they I tell you the truth. It's the truth. The United States took apart all its bombs and sent the fuel for the bombs to Russia, our enemy, our former enemy. And they commercially reprocess that plutonium that we sent them from our bombs, because it's so easy to make. Why make it a secret? It's like ridiculous. And the problem now is too much of this stuff around. They made so many bombs, they don't need all those bombs, and they're trying to take them apart over the last 20 years and try and reduce tensions, which I think is a good thing, actually. And Russia had the only facility left that could handle this stuff, so they took it all. And they're good at it. And so they started watering it down and reprocessing it into fuel for nuclear reactors to make energy. And that's what Russia – and then they sell it around the world. And the U.S. helps them do it, and we have a deal for them to do it. And we want to build a facility here in South Carolina that was near Savannah River that would work with the Russians, and we would both do part of the jobs each, and everybody would profit from this business, right? Because there's many, many – the U.S. has 100 nuclear plants, so there's like 400 or 500 around the world, not counting all the ones that are in submarines and surface ships and things like that both countries have. And those are a different type of reactor, the military reactors that are used for these science fiction undersea weapon systems they have. And so that are still quite secret. And the United States knew about this, and it was a Russian dissident named Zoraz Medved who actually spilled the beans at a conference in the 1970s. And then Ralph Nader and his group filed a Freedom of Information Act, and that's when we first heard, when it was first made public, this vast disaster happened in Russia, right, in 1959. So what is happening now? So we know that the MIAC reactor is working. It's still still closed. It's a semi-closed city, not as closed as it was, but it's under high security. And I was speaking to an associate of mine named Nadezhda Kudipova, who is living in exile in France after her and her children were threatened. She was operating a NGO called Planet of Hopes, where she was helping. Because her father and her grandmother died. They were what they call liquidators. They died of radiation poisoning, cleaning up after these accidents. And so she's like in her 40s now, or early 50s. And so she has four kids. And so she decided to help these people. She's a lawyer, and file suits because Russia's changed. Right, they adopted, at least on the surface, similar type of laws and due process systems that we have here in the United States since the fall of the Soviet Union. And people can sue, just like they do here. And they have lawyers there and courts there and civil fines, and they have laws that protect workers and everything, just like us. And so they started to sue the government, and the government responded. They paid people a lot of money in Russia, in Russian terms, not much by our terms, but in their terms, a lot of money. They paid out to survivors. But then Nadezhda Kudipova started to sue on behalf of third-generation people who claimed that they were suffering from genetic damage, because this radiation damage seems to be passed on genetically for who knows how many generations after the damage. This is from the initial radiation exposure. That's when the government drew the line and said, we don't want to pay these people for generations to come. And so they showed up at her house in Ozersk and filmed her front door and zoomed in on her address in a news report in which they called her, which is the worst thing that could happen to you in Russia, they called her a foreign intelligence agent. That could get you killed there. Just from that, not from the government, just from a citizen on the street, you know, who takes law, justice, or the law into their own hands, for, just like, you know, what happened here, maybe. And so she has four kids, so she had to get out, and she moved to Paris, where she lives now in semi-hiding, and she studies at the Sorbonne. And she wants to go back and continue these lawsuits. So anyway, in October, they started picking up a cloud of this element ruthenium-106. Now, one thing we know about ruthenium-106 is that it's man-made. It's a element. The element is natural, but the form 106 can only be made in nuclear reactors. So it came from a scientific establishment of some sort. They traced the cloud back using computers, and it seems to come from the southern Urals, where Mayak is. And the Russian government said, it's not ours. We deny it. We had no problems here, and nothing happened here. That there's no danger to the people of Mayak, and the emissions of all the radionuclides by the Mayak factories are below limits set by the, they call Rosatom, is the Russian Radiation Protection Administration. And They said it was less than 3% of established limits. But then, a few days later, on October 19th of this year, the authorities in the region changed its position and announced that traces of ruthenium were found, but they were only 200 times below the allowed limits. This is like the same type of arguments the U.S. ever makes when they have these kind of leaks and mini disasters. The origin of this ruthenium is unknown. Right, it's never been detected before. It's difficult to identify, and it's not really sure. Nobody really knows why it even exists, like where it came from. Why would you have this element? What's going on there that they're producing it? It's a secret. They don't know, and we don't know. All right. The governor of the deputy governor Klimov of the Chelyabinsk region said. Claims that Mayak is not the source of the ruthenium contamination. Ruthenium cannot be isolated from other radionuclides, so it would be found with other things. How could it be purely found with no other materials mixed with it, which is an interesting point. Ms. Kudipova believes that this is where it ties into the United States, that it came from the what they call the vitrification of nuclear waste. What they want to do at Hanford, and it's causing them so many problems, is take all this liquid waste that is so dangerous that could explode. It could become a nuclear explosion. It could become a hydrogen explosion. It could throw, imagine how much damage 20,000 gallons in a tank did in Russia. In the United States, we have 50 tanks with about 1 million gallons each in them. What would happen if a 1 million gallon waste tank exploded in the United States? And if a 20,000 gallon tank could destroy tens of thousands of square kilometers, what could a 1 million gallon tank do, right? So in the United States, if it were to explode, and that fear is in the United States, considering what's come out over and over again from whistleblowers, the level of corruption and incompetency that's going on in the United States cleanup operation. And so the fear is really there. So what they do in vitrification is they take the waste. It's a very complex, difficult, and unbelievably expensive. They already spent tens of billions of dollars in the U.S. on it. They already do it in Russia. They fail in the U.S. to get it to work. The Russians are more advanced on this process than the United States. And they take the nuclear waste, and they mix it with glass, and they melt it together, and they glassify it. Vitrification is a fancy word for making something into glass or to glassify something. And they do it in what they call vitrification furnaces. And that way, they think they can take this liquid nuclear waste and immobilize it so they can bury it for the literally hundreds of thousands or millions of years that it's necessary to keep this stuff away from other humans before, where it's still be dangerous. You know, it's going to be dangerous. How do we know what future societies are going to be like? They try to make up little signs that they think will warn people. But how about if instead of warning people away, people see the signs in some future world and say, oh, future, past technology. I wonder what amazing things they had in the past we could learn from today. Let's dig it up, right? Not knowing that the reason for that sign, not understanding that our sign is stay away, this is dangerous, because maybe they have a skull and crossbones mean something different to them, to the humans who come, you know, 100,000 years from now.
Paul, let me ask you, this is a really interesting thing about nuclear products. They just don't go away once they
some do and some don't. Some do and some don't.
The ones that we're talking about at Hanford and other sites, the ones that you've just been talking about in Ozersk, these are not lightweight nuclear materials. These are materials that will have, as you just said, beyond whatever we could construe to be a lifetime. They are not going away.
Well, and that's the thing. They go into – if you – let's say something like iodine-130 – well, iodine, radioactive iodine is only around for 8 days half-life, so maybe 80 days is dangerous, and then it's gone. But if you breathe it in those 80 days, you could have grandchildren and great-grandchildren who have genetic problems because of it.
Well, you've been telling us about these 80 spots. I just want to connect some dots.
In New York here. City, right?
In New York City, 80 spots in New York City found to have elevated radioactive contamination. And is this, in a way, the byproduct of what it is you've just been telling us, these 80 spots and the elevated Radiation.
Well, some of them are radiation. Radioactive materials are ubiquitous. They're all around us. The question is, do we want to make more? The things like ruthenium are man-made. They never existed before. We create so many of them ourselves. You know, this, since the days of the scientists of the 19th century, of the mid 20th century, and at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, who were the first ones to make. Yeah, I think Irene, the daughter of Marie Curie, Irene Arran Curie, and her husband, they were the first ones to discover that you can make artificial isotopes that were radioactive that never existed before. And we make many, many of them, and some have some medical use. They use them in cancer research or other research as tracers and things like that. They use them in spaceships and other things. But these things we're creating, right, are all over the place. We don't know what the effect of bringing them all into the environment would be over a long, long time. Radiation exists naturally in granite. Granite especially has it, and granite often gives off radon, and people who have homes that are where in upstate New York and different places where there's granite rock that's underneath the foundation have been found with high radon levels, because the granite contains the granite contains uranium. The uranium breaks down into radium over time, and the radium breaks down into radon. And so it's a constant process. Like uranium turns it, uranium lasts for 4.5 billion years. It slowly turns into radium, which lasts 1,600 years half-life. And that slowly breaks down into radon, a couple of hundred years, I don't know what it is, half-life. And that radon breaks down into something else. And eventually it all breaks down into lead. And is non-radioactive in the end, but it takes a long time. And it doesn't even matter if it's a short time. If it's 1 minute and you breathe it in for that 1 minute, you could be poisoned and killed, right? And then pass it on even for generations. It's possible, and it has happened. And
could you talk about this cloud?
The granite statues in New York City, all those famous statues everywhere that are on granite pedestals, a lot of those 80 sites are the radiation emanating from the granite pedestals that the statues are, that the statues of the heroic Confederate soldiers are honored on.
So I want to get back to this cloud that surfaced, that was found to be floating across Europe. And initially, it was denied by the Russians that cloud was actually a radioactive, contained radioactive.
They denied it even existed. Then they changed their story and said it did exist. Then it didn't say, they said it came from them. And my expert, who is an expert, who grew up there, who's lost a parent and a grandparent to it, and has become an expert as a lawyer representing people, thinks that it's from the vitrification plant, similar to the one they want to build and having so much problems building in Hanford, Washington.
But where did it go, this cloud?
I have to look up ruthenium, what happens to ruthenium over time. It eventually changes into something else. But while it's ruthenium and you breathe it in, you could get beta. It's beta radiation, right? So it gives off beta, alpha, beta, gamma. And if it gets inside of you, on the outside, it's not, it could cause skin cancer on the outside, but it's not as big a problem. But if you breathe it in and get it into you, it can cause, it gets into your, I don't know what ruthenium, it depends on what element ruthenium is most like. I have to look at the periodic table of the elements. But for example, radium is analog to calcium, so it goes into your bones and then dissolves your bones, because it's not really calcium and it's radioactive. So it's like little bullets, like somebody with a little machine gun inside your bones shooting into your bones while you're alive.
What on the international level, in terms of a regulatory level, what can they do? And what have they done about, I'm using this as the most recent example, that radioactive cloud floating around. But we talked about the sad state of affairs with the actual structural integrity of many of these nuclear facilities around the world.
We've talked about potential terrorists to attack them. And for example, to steal the material to make a dirty bomb out of it, to shoot a missile at a tank or something to blow it up, there are lots of things they could do.
But the regulatory international UN connected regulatory agencies that supposedly oversee all this stuff with all this long created nuclear material. Everybody seems to have it. Everybody, every country that wants to be a part of the power circle has multiple nuclear weapons.
I always mention this. Japan, which is the only country that was attacked with nuclear bombs, actually is sitting on hundreds and hundreds of pounds of plutonium, enough to make thousands of weapons. And then they're trying to get rid of it, actually. They don't want it. But if they needed to, Japan tomorrow could be like could blow up, have enough bombs to blow up 10 countries.
Yes, but the point is
that's Japan.
You know, it's reached a point where people are constantly at risk. You did a lot of work on the Hanford site in Washington State, discussed the contamination, not just on the surface, but we have deep contamination in the water levels and the water tables and the crops and the animals that eat.
And with the downwinders who breathed it in and had, and then you had things like I was mentioning earlier on when they released the iodine on purpose to test their equipment that they were using to detect nuclear tests in Russia. And literally thousands of Americans were contaminated as an experiment with deadly radioactive materials. And there's lots of stories like that.
Who would you say, which countries would you say, you talked about Japan, we certainly talked about Russia, which Iraq, Iran, which countries would you say dominate as the potential source of a catastrophic mishap?
Japan is a very advanced country. Japan's nuclear reactors were among the most advanced in the world, and you had Fukushima because nobody predicted. Why would they? It was so ridiculous to build them on the coast. Why? Where do they get this? Because they won't need it to be near water. You have to cool the reactor with massive amounts of water. So yeah, you have to tether these things. Have to be tethered to a massive source of water, probably more than radiation. When you deal with nuclear power, nuclear reactors, the biggest, by far bigger than radiation, we talk about radiation because it's so woo-woo, but the biggest pollutant is heat. And heat is a pollutant. And just look, we call it climate change caused by global warming, right? And the heat from nuclear plants is released into bodies of water near the nuclear plant, and that causes the actual water temperatures of lakes, rivers, and the ocean to rise. And that changes, that kills fish, millions of fish. You wouldn't believe how many salmon and fish in the Columbia River, billions were killed by this type of operation just from the heat. From the tanks, from the inlet pipes, sucking the fish in and grinding them up in the grates to get the water. That killed more life than anything. You know, so there's lots of things in these plants, these huge industrial operations that are dangerous.
Well, we've begun this leg of the discussion, which will continue, but I want to thank you, Paul, for being with us today. Thanks. And bringing these things to light. I mean, what you just said is an eye-opener for me, that one of the biggest problems and the biggest byproducts is heat. Heat as a pollutant.
That's the biggest pollutant by far. We talk about the radiation because it is so interesting, and the history and the secrecy. You know, you and I, we know each other a long time, Eutrice, and you know both of us are extremely piqued as investigative journalists by anything somebody wants to keep a secret. But the thing that's right out in the open that's no big secret is they dump huge amounts of heat into the ocean.
Wow. I never, ever thought of that.
That's the main pollutant by far.
Until you just said it. So this is your great value, Paul, in doing this kind of work, which you have been doing for many years. And we will continue this conversation, but thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Eutrice. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Right.
Bye.
Well, you can tell that Paul is in New York City. He just heard the sirens behind him. We'll take this short break and come back and talk about a little bit about this election result yesterday. listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Yatrice Lead. And yes, we had a stunning result yesterday in Alabama. But I don't want to talk about, not today, while the euphoria, people are gripped with euphoria and waxing philosophic about what this means for Donald Trump, and is this a turnaround, a political turnaround in America, and all of that. Well, those aspects, in my view, I'll put them on the shelf for the moment. What I want to talk about is that we see another incidence, we see another example of African Americans delivering victory for the underdog, and with the intention that their votes will, in fact, have an impact on all of America to change it for the better. But this has been, since African Americans were allowed to vote, it's so sad to have to say these things, because other people don't have to think about a time when they were not allowed to vote. Voting for African Americans and other people of color, including Native Americans, indigenous folk, we have a whole different story to tell about the vote. But here we saw yesterday, as the underdog was given license to be elevated into the realm of political power, where the Democrat, Doug Jones, who went up against a very odious character, a person now that the Republicans are repudiating and don't want anything at all to do with him. They are moving away from him and what he represents. And I say that that is a ruse. Nobody really moves away who has been in a system like that, like Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions, this whole race was about filling the seat left empty with the appointment of Jeff Sessions to U.S. Attorney General. That did not change Jeff Sessions' politics and political ideas. It didn't. And, so when people say, well, we have a new person, and the feeling is that that new person has new ideas. But they are no different, these new ideas. They don't express a difference from the old ideas that they had. They just have a new office, but with the old ideas. Had Roy Moore, the Trump-endorsed Roy Moore, won, it would have been, he would have taken his old ideas, which are odious, and he would have put them in a pot with the other Trumpites, and it would remain the same. We get the same outcome. But Doug Jones is said to be a liberal. He made his name, and he got that blessing, that tag, as a prosecutor of the bombing of the three girls who were killed in Alabama, in Birmingham. He was the prosecutor. And, some of these things are hyped to make us believe that because that person did a particular thing, it is reflective of that person's real, almost anatomical relationship with our community and its aspirations and its long quest for equality in this country. And people get sidelined by that. They hang on to that, as they did. And I'm not suggesting that he doesn't deserve recognition, but I believe, and I differ with people this way, I believe this was his job. It didn't make him special. This was what he was supposed to do. That's how I think of these things. But it was very good. It worked in his favor. And African Americans actually went beyond the level of voter participation yesterday than they did even for the election of Barack Obama in 2012 and 2008. So I'm fascinated about these things. I'm fascinated by them because we haven't matured as a people, as Americans, but especially as African Americans, we have not matured to the level of deciding how you develop a strategy for how you use your assets. In this race, Senate race in Alabama, there was no strategy. There is no strategy, except we're going to elect the other guy, Bob Jones, elect him. He's a Democrat. And those very things start setting off alarms to me. It is not enough anymore. And it shouldn't be enough simply to say, well, we have a choice to make between A and B. A is really awful. Let's go with B. That's not enough. Our leaders should be able to explain to us or to the people they want votes from, what is the strategy? Why are you endorsing this person? Because he did his job? He was a prosecutor. That's his job. The real hero in all of this is Martin Luther King. But Martin Luther King had always instructed in all of the political initiatives that he undertook, there was a strategy. And a strategy just can't be, well, elect that guy because he's not this guy. That's not a strategy. And while, you know, it is a good thing that blacks were able to create a new reality or a potential new reality, potentially new, it isn't any different from what people have been instructed to do all these centuries. When the first African Americans were elected to Congress, and by the way, they were Republicans, most of them, and by the way, the Republican Party was literally created out of black fervor and strategy. They created it. That was a strategy. And it worked because it created a groundswell of political power. But we have come to embrace a super simplistic idea about the potentiality of our political power, which boils down to vote for him. And that's as far as it goes. So that I don't see it as a victory necessarily. I see it more as a warning sign that we must become far more politically sophisticated than we currently are, because we haven't moved away from the old formula devised by the system. We can't accept that it is enough simply to move or to allow ourselves to be moved into a position to empower our other people, whether they are liberal or not. They still are part of a system that allows them far more latitude over the very people putting them in office. We no longer have access once that job is done. So it bothered me a great deal that here we see evidence of the enormous potential of Black political power to create beneficial change, meaningful change. But it still is reduced to that old formula. Just get this guy elected, that woman elected, and that's enough. The political leaders who are brought before the community, the African-American leaders who are brought before the community, don't themselves have credentials to play this role, but they are compelled to do so. They are made to do so by the party and by the system. The Democratic Party has been lethal to Black interests and the interests of broadly of people of color. The Democratic Party, for all intents and purposes, is useless to Blacks. It has betrayed time and again the aggregate interests of Black people. It doesn't deserve one whit of support, because it has been strategically used. Black political power has been strategically used, actually, to disempower Blacks. It's the Democratic Party is a virus, a life-destroying virus for Blacks. And they seem not to understand that. And here we were last night, and, you know, everybody's excited. This is an underdog. He's a good white man, and he certainly is the better choice than that bad white man. So elect the good white man. And forget the fact that that's all you are expected to do. The doors of power are not opening up to you. The basic changes that are desperately needed and have been needed for a long, long time will still remain on the shelf, unattended to, because now there are new realities. And your vote, your Black vote, is to empower a white system to exploit you. I just don't get it. Maybe there's something wrong with me. When we get back our phone systems, maybe you talk me through this thing and you will let me know what a crazy person I am to be thinking this way. But I said, well, there we go. A new round of the same old formula. And we must reject it. We have to steel ourselves with the courage that Martin Luther King had. His struggle was for the vote, for jobs, for justice. We haven't gotten any of the three. And his energy, the energy that he poured into educating Black people about the power of their potential, their political potential, you develop it and you don't let it go. And you strategically use it. Our leaders don't have that conscientiousness anymore, or consciousness. They're done. It's about working through Congress to the best of the ability that they have, and they're trapped because all of their power is checked by very average and sometimes wait, that's a compliment. In Congress, we had just witnessed an African-American congressman from Texas doing a brave thing. It may not have been perfect, but he stood up and said, here are my articles of impeachment. And he looked around, nobody was there. And they weren't there because Nancy Pelosi, the white queen of the Democrats, instructed them that they are not to presume to move in a political way that supersedes what she believes to be the cap on their power. I talked about it just yesterday. So we have to have, at this time, this is a time for reflection. This is a time for introspection. This is a time for accountability and finding a new way. The formula is dead. It is supposed to be, it should be, anathema to all of us. And we will continue this conversation of hearing my hint that it's time for me to go. Thanks for listening, and we come to each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.